Talking Books. Over the last few years, I've interviewed perhaps 100 people on various programmes on Campus FM, the lecture room, the artefact, research matters, and of course Talking Books. And I'm very grateful to the radio for having given me the opportunity to talk to so many interesting people. Today, however, I'm going to talk about my own favourite books and read some short excerpts from them. Books were part of my life from the word go. The house was lined with them, my parents' bedside tables were covered with them, and my elder sisters always had a book hanging out of their hands. My earliest memories are of our local library, which is where my mother always gravitated after shopping in town. She never really liked taking me, because I couldn't, or rather wouldn't, understand the silence rule, and embarrassed her so much that she usually parked me in the children's museum next door. My father was born in 1907 to rather Victorian parents, whose idea of educational books were cautionary tales such as Der Struwwelpeter, a popular German children's book by Heinrich Hoffmann, written in 1845, first translated into English in 1848. It is made up of 10 beautifully illustrated and rhymed stories, mostly about children, and each has a clear moral that demonstrates the disastrous consequences of misbehaviour in an exaggerated way. The stories would make today's pedagogists' blood run cold. But I feel perhaps there are some people who might benefit from listening well to this example. The Story of the Inky Boys. As he had done often before, the woolly-headed blackamoor, one nice fine summer's day went out to see the shops and walk about. And as he found it hot, poor fellow, he took with him his green umbrella. Then Edward, little noisy wag, ran out and laughed and waved his flag. And William came in jacket trim and brought his wooden hoop with him. And Caspar too snatched up his toys and joined the other naughty boys. So one and all set up a roar and laughed and hooted more and more and kept on singing, "Only think, oh Blackie, you're as black as ink." Now St. Nicholas lived close by, so tall he almost touched the sky. He had a mighty inkstand, too, in which a great goose feather grew. He called out in an angry tone, "Boys, leave the blackamoor alone, for if he tries with all his might, he cannot change from black to white." But, ah, they did not mind a bit what St. Nicholas said of it, but went on laughing as before and hooting at the blackamoor. Then St. Nicholas foams with rage. Look at him on this very page. He seizes Caspar, seizes Ned, takes William by his little head, and they may scream and kick and call, but into the ink he dips them all. Into the ink stand 1, 2, 3, till they are black as black can be. Turn over now, and you will see. See, there they are, and there they run. The blackamoor enjoys the fun. They have been made as black as crows, quite black all over, eyes and nose and legs and arms and heads and toes, and trousers, pinafores and toys, the silly little inky boys, because they set up such a roar and teased the harmless blackamoor. As my sisters and I all grew up, I was considered too young to play with. What do a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old want with a 4-year-old sibling? I was only useful to play the very lowly parts in their plays invented for our parents. This state of affairs led me to spend long hours seated under an acer bush at the bottom of the garden, with a book pinched from the shelves under the stairs. The reading was usually some summer holiday adventure story like Swallows and Amazons, or my all-time favourite, Brendan Chase. The idea of holidays spent in a forest was deeply attractive to me, and I must have read B.B.'s classic innumerable times. Today I find the male pursuits of shooting rabbits and pigeons, as described in the book, slightly distasteful. But aged 10, I suppose I thought it was rather fun. This is how the book opens. The end of the Easter holidays was drawing very near. Only two more days remained before 500-odd boys, whose ages range from 12 to 19, would discard their carefree clothes to don the well-pressed trousers, the speckled straw hats and black-tailed coats, which, from time immemorial, had been the garb of all Manchestians. Farewells would be taken, some resigned, some sad, some even joyful. Handkerchiefs would flutter down many a long platform, heads would cram many a window as the inexorable chuffing engine drew them away from their loved ones and all they held dear. But to the three boys sitting together dreading the thought of another term at school, this did not apply. Their parents had gone abroad when the youngest boy, Harold, was only 3 years old, and they had been entrusted to the care of a maiden aunt who knew nothing of children and never understood boys. But their environment had one redeeming feature, namely the old dower house and its old-fashioned garden, set snugly in a well-wooded county with streams and rivers abounding. They escaped to the fields and spinneys whenever possible, bird-nesting, fishing and poaching with catapult and air gun, and in general getting up to those tricks young boys love to play. So that though the home atmosphere was strained, the old house and grounds, the thickly timbered country and the adjacent weald exercised a great fascination, and they had come to love it. A large part of my reading was always poetry, and it is something that I turn to even today for some spiritual renewal. I went through all the various poetic stages, the romantics, the war poets, odd ones like Yashchenko and Conrad Aitken, but also the obvious ones like Auden. I've chosen one short poem of Auden's, number 11 of his 12 songs, sometimes entitled Roman Wall Blues. Anybody with a Mediterranean soul can empathise with the wall soldiers' misery. Over the heather the wet wind blows. I've lice in my tunic and a cold in my nose. The rain comes pattering out of the sky. I'm a wall soldier. I don't know why. The mist creeps over the hard grey stone. My girl's in Tangria. I sleep alone. Aulus goes hanging around her place. I don't like his manners. I don't like his face. Piso's a Christian. He worships a fish. There'd be no kissing if he had his wish. She gave me a ring, but I diced it away. I want my girl, and I want my pay. When I'm a veteran with only one eye, I shall do nothing but look at the sky. Every book one reads, I suppose, leaves some kind of impression upon one's brain, but clearly some resonate more than others. One of the very resonating ones for me was Laura Esquivel's Like Water for Chocolate. Ours was a mono family, just my parents and my sisters, with no cousins or aunts living nearby, but despite this isolation, or perhaps because of my mother's Mediterranean background, for us, eating, particularly Sunday lunch, was an important affair. My mother had a large silver recipe book, written in Italian, which I suspect she had taken from her own mother's kitchen as she left to start her new life in the UK. In my youth, I knew no Italian, and so to me and to my sisters, this book seemed like Merlin's Book of Spells. Mummy would murmur the ingredients sotto voce, and then drop a bit of this into the pot, and then a piece of that. She was a reluctant, but a very good cook, and for me her ratatouille remains unequalled. I then found myself living in Malta with three sisters-in-law for whom cooking was of great import. Very clever of me, really, because I'm no great shakes in the kitchen myself. Eating for my new family was and is always a time for talk, a time to complain, a time to wash out problems and hand out advice, asked for or not. Before Christmas, all the family members, their boyfriends and girlfriends, meet, don aprons, yes, the men as well, and make dozens of ravioletti by hand to be eaten at Christmas and on New Year's Day. The discussions and the passion, the physicality of rubbing dough and stirring puddings or smelling the sauce are all straight out of Like Water for Chocolate. I hasten to add, of course, that here the similarities with the story end. Thank goodness neither my own family nor my Maltese family are at all dysfunctional like that of Mama Elena. But reading the book suddenly gave a new dimension to my understanding of the Mediterranean way of being. This is a short extract. It was useless to try to recall the first time she had smelt one of those rolls. She couldn't, possibly because it had been before she was born. It might have been the unusual combination of sardines and sausages that had called to her and made her decide to trade the peace of ethereal existence in Mama Elena's belly for life as her daughter, in order to enter the De La Garza family and share their delicious meals and wonderful sausage. On Mama Elena's ranch, sausage-making was a real ritual. The day before, they started peeling garlic, cleaning chilies and grinding spices. All the women in the family had to participate, Mama Elena, her daughters Gertrudis, Rosaura and Tita, Naja, the cook, and Chencha, the maid. They gathered around the dining table in the afternoon, and between the talking and the joking, the time flew by until it started to get dark. Then Mama Elena would say, "That's it for today." For a good listener, it is said, a single word will suffice. So when they heard that, they all sprang into action. First they had to clear the table, then they had to assign tasks. One collected the chickens, another drew water for breakfast from the well, a third was in charge of wood for the stove. There would be no ironing, no embroidery, no sewing that day. When it was all finished, they went to the bedrooms to read, say their prayers, and go to sleep. In a recent interview with novelist Patricia Duncker, I was listening to her talk about Graham Greene. For me, it is his mastery of the short story that I find so fascinating. And one of his sharpest examples is The Destructors, which left me breathless when I read it for the first time. Pure and almost inexplicable cruelty is writ large in this brief narrative. On Sunday morning, all were punctual except Blackie, even Mike. Mike had a stroke of luck. His mother felt ill, his father was tired after Saturday night, and he was told to go to church alone with many warnings of what would happen if he strayed. Blackie had difficulty in smuggling out the saw and then in finding the sledgehammer at the back of number 15. He approached the house from a lane at the rear of the garden for fear of the policeman's beat along the main road. The tired evergreens kept off a stormy sun. Another wet bank holiday was being prepared over the Atlantic, beginning in swirls of dust under the trees. Blackie climbed the wall into Misery's garden. There was no sign of anybody anywhere. The lav stood like a tomb in a neglected graveyard. The curtains were drawn. The house slept. Blackie lumbered nearer with the saw and the sledgehammer. Perhaps, after all, nobody had turned up. The plan had been a wild invention. They had woken wiser. But when he came close to the back door, he could hear a confusion of sound, hardly louder than a hive in swarm. A clickety-clack, a bang-bang, a scraping, a creaking and sudden painful crack, he thought. It's true, and whistled. They opened the back door to him and he came in. He had at once the impression of organisation, very different from the old happy-go-lucky ways under his leadership. For a while he wandered up and down looking for tea. Nobody addressed him. He had a sense of urgency, and already he could begin to see the plan. The interior of the house was being carefully demolished without touching the walls. Summers, with hammer and chisel, was ripping out the skirting board in the ground-floor dining room. He had already smashed the panels of the door. In the same room, Joe was heaving up the parquet blocks, exposing the softwood floorboards over the cellar. Coils of wire came out of the damaged skirting, and Mike sat happily on the floor, clipping the wires. On the curved stairs, two of the gang were working hard with an inadequate child's saw on the banisters. When they saw Blackie's big saw, they signalled for it wordlessly. When he next saw them, a quarter of the banisters had been dropped into the hall. He found tea, at last, in the bathroom. He sat moodily in the least cared-for room in the house, listening to sounds coming up from below. "You've really done it," Blackie said with awe. "What's going to happen?"
"We've only just begun," T said. He looked at the sledgehammer and gave his instructions. "You stay here and break the bath and the wash basin. Don't bother about the pipes, they come later."
Mike appeared at the door. "I've finished the wires, T," he said. "Good. You've just got to go wandering round now. The kitchen's in the basement. Smash all the china and glass and bottles you can lay hold of. Don't turn on the taps. We don't want a flood. Yet. Then go into all the rooms and turn out the drawers. If they're locked, get one of the others to break them open. Tear up any papers you find and smash all the ornaments. Better take a carving knife with you from the kitchen. The bedroom's opposite here. Open the pillows and tear up the sheets. That's enough for the moment. And you, Blackie, when you've finished in here, crack the plaster in the passage up with your sledgehammer."
"What are you going to do?" Blackie asked.
"I'm looking for something special," T said.
It was nearly lunchtime, before Blackie had finished and went in search of tea. Chaos had advanced. The kitchen was a shambles of broken glass and china. The dining room was stripped of parquet, the skirting was up, the door had been taken off its hinges, and the destroyers had moved upper floor. Streaks of light came in through the closed shutters where they worked with the seriousness of creators. And destruction, after all, is a form of creation. A kind of imagination had seen this house as it had now become.
"Like every human being, I imagine, I'm always seeking something which, in its most basic terms, I suppose, will help to explain our place in this universe. The hermetic quest is one of those frustrating ideas that are so very attractive, but that can have no real end. In our heart of hearts, we know that the answer to everything is elusive, but it's nice to dream about that possibility for a moment. The Chemical Wedding by Lindsay Clark is a parallel plot historical novel that moves from the 19th to the 20th century and plays two stories against each other, or rather dovetailing them. It uses the hermetic quest as its leitmotif, but is really, I suppose, a narrative of two groups of people who seek to know themselves. Here is an extract taken from the dramatic moment in which the 19th century protagonist realizes that her father's life's work is based on false premise. "But there were no wings, no crown. The room, like the sounds outside, was commonplace, and he was neither priest to the god nor priest to the goddess either. He was simply the fallible man she loved, and in that, priest, perhaps, to the great sea which lies between us all." She turns to take in her father's troubled gaze. "We must recall the book," she says, "and we shall burn it." Her voice is absolute, practical. and he is awed and shamed by this sudden enthusiasm for what had been his own intolerable desire. Shocked, he recalls how often he had sat in the library, willing the whole world to flame as he himself was in flame. He knows the desire and understands it. He knows it is a lust for destruction and fears to see it unfettered now in her. Was this to be the end of all his labours then, to see the star fire at his daughter's soul turn to smoke and ash? No! In a rage born of insupportable remorse, the word leaps to his throat. No! That must never be! She watches as his face slowly dissolves before him. He is all tears, the breath breaking from him, and with it, however incoherently, however difficult its stammering, the admission of his falsity, his bitter truth. Where she had succeeded, he is striving to say, he himself has failed. He has failed from the dismal ignobility of spirit which lacked the courage to endure. His soul is craven, his will abused. And if, he confesses quaking, I have sought to deny your work, it is because I cannot bear the light it casts upon the irredeemable failure of my own. My first visit to Malta was as a seven-year-old. We stayed with my aunt in a flat in Floriana. The August heat was overwhelming. Not for me so much as for my Celtic-skinned father, who insisted on sticking to the siesta rule. I got bored stiff and kept bothering him during the afternoon. So one day, simply to give me something to do, he decided to teach me a poem. He taught it to me from his own memory, which was slightly flawed, so I learnt it with all his errors. Today I'm going to read it from a proper text, so that I don't get it wrong. Edward Lear has a special connection, of course, with Malta, so it was quite appropriate that he should teach me one of his poems, The Owl and the Pussycat. This piece of nonsense was written in 1867 for the children of his patron, the Earl of Derby. Lear was not always very complimentary about Malta, as it seems he didn't manage to sell very many paintings while he was here. And he also, like my dad, found the heat a bit too much. Lear first came to Malta in 1848, and then again the following year, and in 1865. To see an amazing example of Lear's painting, do visit the Palazzo Falzon Museum in Umdina, which holds the Olof Golscher collection. It's a delightful museum, worth visiting anyway, but especially for the Lear work. Here is the whimsical poem. The Owl and the Pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money, wrapped up in a £5 note. The owl looked up to the stars above and sang to a small guitar. Oh, lovely pussy, oh, pussy, my love, what a beautiful pussy you are, you are, you are. What a beautiful pussy you are. Pussy said to the owl, you elegant fowl, how charmingly sweet you sing. Oh, let us be married. Too long we have tarried, but what shall we do for a ring? They sailed away for a year and a day to the land where the bong tree grows. And there in a wood a piggywig stood with a ring at the end of his nose, his nose, his nose, with a ring at the end of his nose. Dear pig, will you sell for 1 shilling your ring? Said the piggy. I will. So they took it away and were married next day by the turkey who lives on the hill. They dined on mince and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon, and hand in hand on the edge of the sand they danced by the light of the moon, the moon, the moon. They danced by the light of the moon. I'm going to finish with something from my children's early years. Reading to them was a great joy. I must have read this little story to them 1,000 times, And my attempts to skip a paragraph or two were always met with complaining wails. Here are the last three pages of Beatrix Potter's The Tale of Peter Rabbit. Peter never stopped running or looked behind him till he got home to the big fir tree. He was so tired that he flopped down upon the nice soft sand on the floor of the rabbit hole and shut his eyes. His mother was busy cooking. She wondered what he had done with his clothes. It was the second little jacket and pair of shoes that Peter had lost in a fortnight. I'm sorry to say that Peter was not very well during the evening. His mother put him to bed and made some chamomile tea, and she gave a dose of it to Peter. One tablespoonful to be taken at bedtime. But Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail had bread and milk and blackberries for supper. Next week's programme will be the last in this summer series of Talking Books. My guest will be Dr. James Corby, and we'll be discussing poetry. I do hope that you'll be able to join us. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.